Terrifying visions of the vengeance of the twice-lived prophet make the young ones wake, crying out in fear, dreams of a destroyer. Oh, yes, you have manipulated events, but your petty vengeance has cascaded us into a very dangerous place. Blind he sees the way, and the wolf comes at his heels. The prophecy of the unexpected son had been fulfilled to our detriment. It was done, and we looked to the newer dreams to find our way. But you have woken the sleeping wolf and stirred the dragons in him to fury. You have set us on a dark path indeed with your vanity and your anger and your selfish need for vengeance.
Dwalia was stronger than she looked. I already knew that from the times we had fought. But now she lifted me from my feet and carried me forward, kicking and struggling. Then she threw me at Capra. I hit the edge of the dais in front of the blue-clad woman and fell to the hard floor, clutching my bruised ribs. There was no air left in my body. I could not squeak, let alone scream.
"You stupid old woman!"
Dwalia did not roar the words, but spoke them in a dark, cold voice. Two men with spears seized her by the arms and dragged her away, but even as they did so, she spoke on as coolly as if they hadn't touched her.
"You refused to read what my examination of the dreams told me. You wouldn't listen to me the first time I warned you about that creature you had taken in. I told you he would free the dragons. You said he could not. I begged you to let me go with Illistor, that I might protect her. You all refused. You said Keeble Rawbread would be enough. But he wasn't, and so she died. She died horribly, alone and broken and cold, and the dragons you so fear were loosed upon the world."
Dwalia was not struggling. The guards held her arms, but looked as if they felt foolish. Vindelire was rocking back and forth where he knelt, breathing in noisy nose gasps. I lay where I had fallen, trying for air, watching her.
"Beloved is dead," she went on. "I know it. I feel it. I've killed him in the worst way he could possibly imagine, and I've stolen the weapon he and his catalyst were shaping to use against us. I've brought you the unexpected son from the prophecies, and all you can do is sit up there and refuse to let me enlighten you. I expect Capra to ignore my revelations. She has always hated me, and all Belodi can think of is his lechery, while Koltri fears that if he speaks any truth, you will all turn on him and rebuke him for the imposter he has always been. But Simph, I thought better of you. I thought you were wiser. I always believed that one day you would throw the other three down and rule Clarez as it should be ruled. But no, you hold the threads of all time in your hands, and yet you will let them unravel in our lifetime. I've brought you what you need to make up for how stupid you were about Beloved, but you sit there like toads on stones and do nothing."
"How dare you attack me? How dare you speak to any of us in such a tone? Guardsmen, 10 lashes!
Capra ordered one of the guards who held Dwalia, her voice as cold as ice. The man released Dwalia to his companion's safekeeping and caught her by both wrists. Still, she did not struggle. The first guardsman bowed precisely to the four and swiftly left the room.
20,
Koltri countered.
"Those were exquisite horses, all lost to me now."
There was no regret or sympathy in his voice. He might have been asking for a drink of water.
20?
Capra was outraged.
"How can you pretend your injury is greater than mine? How dare you?" 10 then, 10. But those were fine horses."
Koltri subsided into a sulk, fussing with a green silk handkerchief he pulled from his sleeve.
"Irreplaceable.
he muttered, drawing another glare from Capra.
So messy. So physical. 10. Now. Let us be done with this.
Felody closed his eyes wearily, as if it were all too inconvenient for him even to consider. The beautiful woman Simph spoke last.
Twalia, you have gone too far. Too often I have allowed you to speak in blunt terms, but your insults are beyond honesty. I cannot protect you from this. 5 lashes, she suggested.
There was regret in her voice, but not a great deal of it. Capra turned a furious gaze on her.
5? 5? You insult me too! You insult Coltrane, who lost a generation of steeds. She does not say she killed Beloved, only that she believes he is dead. She has disobeyed and defied us and...
10, then, Simph amended. Let it be 10 and let it be over. It has been too long a day already.
Capra was shaking her head.
We will have this be over and leave this chamber, but this evening I wish to see all of you in my tower chamber.
I heard the guard's boots, his heels striking the floor very precisely, the jingling of the chain a music to the beat of his footsteps. I sat up slowly, my back to the dais, feeling dizzy and sick. I watched dully as the guard lifted a small panel of the smooth white floor and attached the chains to a ring there. Dwalia still sounded very calm and rational.
No, it's not fair. It's not right, no.
The guard who dragged her forward paid no attention to her words or her attempts to sink her nails into his forearm and free herself. She braced her feet on the smooth floor, yet he dragged her effortlessly. When he reached his partner, the other man seized her hair and clacked 2 pieces of metal around her throat. She struggled while he put the clips through the collar. Both guards stepped back abruptly, and there she was, Dwalia, who had terrorized me for so long, chained like a dog, the heavy loops of metal from the collar around her neck secured to the ring in the floor. It was a short chain. She could not stand upright. For a moment, she stood bent over, glaring at the floor. Then she hunched down, crossing her arms on her chest and tucking her face in as tightly as she could. I could hear Vindelire breathing loudly, a shrill note to each breath he expelled, but he did not move from where he knelt. This was not new to either of them, I realized as the two guards stepped back. One gave the other a stick to match the one he held. No, not a stick. Each unfurled short lashes attached to heavy braided leather handles. Whips. They shook them loose in an expert fashion, and each took a position to either side of Dwalia.
You are fools!
She shouted in one last attempt at outrage, but her voice shook with fear as one of the guards made his lash whistle in a practice swipe. Then it began. It was not 10 lashes, it was 40, 10 decreed by each of the 4. The guards alternated their blows, the lashes rising and falling as rhythmically as a smith's hammer. Dwalia could not escape. Terribly, between blows, she almost had time to decide where the lash would next fall. But the guardsmen were experienced, or perhaps just cruel. Always, the lash seemed to fall on fresh flesh, or cleverly bisect the welt his partner had just created. Her garments leapt at each blow. At first, she stayed hunched where she was, the lovely cloth of the back of the dress the captain had bought for his lover, frayed, and finally fell away. She began to give short shrieks and to scuttle like a beetle all around the ring in the floor. The guards did not care. She could not evade them. Her flesh welted and oozed, and droplets of blood began to speckle the floor and the strong, bared arms of the guardsmen. Before they finished, the lashes were slapping raw meat and flinging arcs of blood. 40 had never seemed so large a number before. I covered my ears. I closed my eyes. Somehow, I still heard the sounds that she made. They were not screams, nor curses, nor even pleas. They were terrible sounds. My eyes kept opening, no matter how tightly I closed them. There she was, the person who had ruined my life, the person I hated most in the whole world, being torn and slashed and ripped and tattered by whips of leather. They did to her what I had so longed to do to her, and it was disgusting and horrifying and unbearable. I was a little trapped animal. I panted and whined and wept, but no one took any notice of me. I peed myself, soaking my trousers and making a puddle at my feet. I learned in that afternoon that I would have saved her if I could, that while I might hate her enough to kill her, I did not think I could ever hate anyone enough to torture them. Dwalia managed to protect her eyes, but it cost her damage to her hands. The tips of the lashes curled cleverly to slice her shoulder and then lick a scarlet tip across her cheek. She could hide her face in her hands, but then the backs of her hands were vulnerable. She had begun with her arms crossed on her chest and her hands tucked protectively close, but she ended collapsed on her side, her legs drawn up to her belly and her face hidden in the crook of one bloodied arm. Her punishment was done with swift efficiency, but in those long and paralyzed moments, I felt the rushing, dragging, shifting currents of time. Every stripe fell in a predetermined place on her body. Every twitch of her shuddering flesh changed that place. But it changed it in a logical and defined way. While my stomach churned at what they did to her, a calm part of my mind made orderly sense of every violent action and her reaction to it. I saw that if she moved this way, the guard would shift his arm, and the lash would strike there, and the blood would fly just so. It was all predetermined. None of it was random. In that horrifying recognition, I suddenly saw how each action we had taken had moved us forward to this place and time, and to this event. As late as this morning, there had been 1,000 opportunities to choose a different path that would not have led us to this bloody resolution. Dwalia could have chosen to remain Lady Obricia and gone to the inn to wait for her captain. She could have sent a messenger bird ahead to Symph and arranged a secret meeting. She could have leapt overboard and drowned herself, or stayed on the ship. There had been so many ways to divert her path to avoid this disaster. Why had she not seen and known or guessed this would happen? Why had I not foreseen that she would drag me into this with her? I did not know enough of these people to predict what would happen to me.
38. 39.
The guards had been counting, each calling the strike of his own lash. Now they chorused,
40.
And both whips fell. Slowly, slowly they drew the leather straps back and coiled the wet leather thongs around the handle. Their fingers were bloody, their strong arms and stoic faces speckled with blood. Dwalia remained where she was, panting. She had long ceased crying out. What was the sense in crying out when it would avail you nothing? All the nights I had whispered pleas for my father to find me had availed me nothing. The wash of futility I felt left me cold and empty, and free to act. Capra cleared her throat. If she was moved at all by the horror she had inflicted on Dwalia, it did not show in her voice as she issued her commands.
Take her to the lowest levels. Confine her there. Vindelia, go to your chamber and resume your old duties tomorrow.
Vindelia was already in motion, scuttling for the door. He looked back once at Dwalia, his mouth turned down in a grimace. Then he was sidling out the door, and it closed behind him. It took both guards to get Dwalia to her feet. One unfastened the chain from her neck as the other unhooked it from the floor ring and returned the panel to its place. Then each guard took an arm and stood her up between them. She could not walk, but lurched and stumbled and dragged. The sounds of pain she made were pitiful. I stayed where I was. For one awful moment, she lifted her head. Her eyes burned with hatred of me. Her hands had bloody welts on the backs where she had sheltered her face from the lashes. She pointed a shaking finger at me and said something.
"What was that?" she said,
Coltrane demanded. No one spoke. Perhaps no one else had made out her words. I had.
"Your turn now."
Chapter 24. Hand and Foot.
A rat's head on a stick. No one holds the stick, but it is shaken at the dreamer. The rat squeaks.
The bait is the trap, the trapper, the trapped.
The rat's mouth is red, its teeth yellow, its eyes are black and shining. It appears to be the sort of large brown rat, often seen near the docks of Clara's town. It has a black and white ruff about its neck, and the staff it is fixed to is green and yellow.
Capra's Dream, 903872. Recorded by Lingstra O.Q.
Well, that was unpleasant, Simph muttered.
Blame yourself,
Capra countered.
You created that moment, releasing Beloved lying to me, allowing that sour-faced wretch to think she had the perspicacity of a white prophet. You encouraged her to create this mess. I suppose I must be the one to set events back on their proper course.
I will take charge of the child, Simph announced. I heard their voices as one might hear flies buzzing at a window. Twalia was gone. Only her spattered and smeared blood remained. Vindelire was gone. I was alone in this place they had brought me to. I stared up at the lovely woman. Pretty did not mean kind. She did not look at me.
That you shall not,
Capra announced.
We should all have access to her to determine her value,
Felody suggested. Capra laughed low.
We know what value you would give her, Felody. No.
Coltrey spoke in a low voice.
Do away with the creature, right now. It will only cause division among us, and we've had enough of that. Recall how Beloved's return set us against one another.
He frowned so severely that the cosmetics on his face flaked a sprinkling of powder.
Never do what you can't undo until you've perceived what you can't do once you've done it. That is among our oldest teachings, you idiot. We need to summon collators and search for any possible references to her.
Simph spoke smoothly.
That will take days,
Coltrey objected.
As you are not the one who will be doing the work, why should you care?
Felody replied. In a quieter voice he added,
As if you could understand the dreams, having never had any of your own.
Do you think I'm deaf?
Coltrey demanded angrily, to which Felody smiled and replied,
Of course not. You are merely blind to the futures.
Enough,
Capra snapped. She glanced at me, and I looked away. I feared to have her look into my eyes. Something in her stare seemed to gloat, as if she kept to herself some bit of knowledge.
Simph, I propose that we hold her in the upper cells, in safety, in health. Perhaps she is nothing but a blonde child stolen from scutwork in Fitzchivalry's home. Dwalia offered us no proof that she is otherwise. If she were truly of Beloved's lineage, she would be dreaming by now, and Dwalia would have offered the records of her dreams to us as proof of her value. I suspect she is nothing but a ruse, an excuse for Dwalia's losses.
Then why not leave her with me? Simph demanded. I could use another maidservant. Capra's look was deadly.
A ruse can be used more than once, dear girl. Dwalia claims Beloved is dead. She said nothing of Fitzchivalry, his catalyst. If this child is his or has value to him, we may find that once more we deal with the unexpected son. The real one, the one who aided Beloved to thwart us. So she needs to be confined until we determine if there is any truth to Dwalia's tale. Until we have wrung the full truth from both Dwalia and that monster she has cultivated.
I do not think that is necessary. What do you... Capra spoke over her.
or I will have them all killed, as I should have done with Beloved.
My heart was beating so hard at their words that I thought my whole body shook with it. Silence fell. Coltrey spoke.
What right have you to dictate to us? There are four of us. I have the right of my years, my experience, my wisdom, and as you went behind my back with your decision to allow Beloved to escape, I think it is my turn to make a decision in which none of you have a say.
She paused, and satisfaction gleamed in her fish eyes.
Oh, look away and pretend you could deceive me. Such a farce. Do you think I do not know how you diverted funds and resources to Dwalia? You think I have no knowledge of the bird messages she used to send back to you?
She shook her head at their naivety, and her smile was a terrible thing to see.
You have forgotten who dreams better and deeper and more than any of you or your Clare's bred whites. You thought you had kept your secrets from me, but I have balanced that scale with the dreams I've withheld from you. While you indulged Dwalia's profitless quest for revenge, you ignored our larger problem. Not a child who may or may not be of the white bloodline, but the damnable dragons. All we sought to prevent has happened. Dragons are loose in the world again, and the Lurics who remain to us are dreaming dark visions of wolves and suns and dragons. We came within a fingersnap of ending them forever. Yet dragons do not forgive, and dragons do not forget. But apparently you three do forget that, above all, dragons do not forget a wrong done them. It is time you stopped playing at petty politics here and looked to the future. Beloved has cracked the foundation of our knowledge, but we are rebuilding it with new dreams and prophecies. We can take back the rudder and steer the world to our advantage, but all that would end if we were to look up and see wings in the skies over Clara's.
A silence fell, during which I came slowly to my feet. I was ashamed of my wet trousers. They clung to me, cold now. I clutched my little bundle to my chest and allowed the tears to come to my eyes. I'd had time to weave a pitiful shield of lies. I tried to hope they would work. I want to go home. Please. I don't understand any of this. I just want to go home. Their gazes converged on me, exhibiting various degrees of astonishment and disapproval. I made my lower lip quiver. Simph, the lovely young woman, spoke sternly.
You do not speak to any of us unless we tell you. Is that clear?
I lowered my gaze. Could I use this? Yes, ma'am. Dwalia told me not to talk to any of you. I should have remembered. I kept my head bent, but tried to watch them through my lashes. Simph looked uncomfortable. I dared myself and spoke in the most childish voice I could muster.
Dwalia said we would talk to Simph alone, or with Felody. She taught me dreams to say. Do you want to hear them now?
Simph must have given a signal, something I didn't see. The swung foot of the guard swept my feet from under me, my elbow struck the floor hard, and the pain shot into my hand and my shoulder. I clutched it and curled around it.
A cell, Simph suggested coldly. On the lower level. Take her now.
Again I was seized by the back of my shirt and handled like a sack. I hugged my little bundle of clothing, hoping it would shield me from the blow I expected. My toes barely touched the floor as the guards dragged me to the tall doors. Behind me, I heard Simph declare,
I propose that later tonight we gather. We will talk, and then we will go together to see what she has to say. Until then, no one should visit her. No one.
The old woman laughed.
Oh, dear little Simph, did she start to tell your secrets? Did you really believe that I did not already know?
The doors closed on her words. My collar was cutting into my throat. I clutched at it with both hands.
Let her breathe,
said the guard who didn't have hold of me, and I was abruptly dropped to the floor. I sprawled there, gasping. I could smell Dwalia's blood on both of them, and garlic. One of them needed a bath, badly.
"Get up,"
one said, and nudged me with his sandaled foot. I obeyed, but slowly. There were people in the corridor, staring at us. I looked down, blood smears on the floor. They'd brought Dwalia this way. They were going to put me in a cell near her. With her? Dread froze me.
"Walk or be dragged,"
the same guard said.
"Walk,"
I said breathlessly. Would there be a chance for me to break free and run?
Run where?
Then, from behind us, I heard a call.
"Guards, wait."
It was Felody who called to us.
"It has been decided we will keep her on the upper level, behind a lock of four. Take her there. We will join you shortly."
"We obey,"
one of the guards said. The one that had caught me by the collar gave me a push. I walked past well-dressed folk who turned to gawk after us as they herded me along. A door opened to one side, and I glimpsed a beautiful ballroom. Two girls my age, dressed all in lace and escorted by pages, stared curiously as they passed us, and the guards hurried me along to get me out of their sight. The first flight of stairs lifted in a wide spiral. My guards did not pause on the landing, and even though I was panting and half sick by then, I climbed alongside them up the second flight of stairs, and then along a brown, panelled corridor. At intervals, shelves jutted from the walls, each holding a fat lamp shaped rather like a teapot. There were no windows to admit light, but there were doors to either side of the carpeted hall. We moved through a perpetual gloom. The burning oil smelled like a pine forest. We passed an open door, and I had a glimpse of a room that was lined with little boxed shelves with scrolls sticking out of them. From floor to ceiling they went, and it reminded me of a honeycomb or the chambers in a paper wasp nest. At long tables, people sat with scrolls unfurled and waited to lie open beside stacks of paper and inkpots and penstands. I wanted to stare, but when I slowed, one of the guards slapped me on the back of my head.
"Walk,"
he reminded me, and I walked. We passed another chamber full of tables, with the walls lined with books rather than scrolls. Scribes lifted their eyes from the pages and stared as we passed. I saw no windows, but squares of light shone through the stonework. I'd never seen such a thing. Some of the people in there were not much older than me, and others were older than my father. Their robes were all a rich green. They were not whites, and I guessed that these were the servants of the whites. No one spoke as we passed, though I felt their curious glances. At the end of the corridor was a door and yet another set of steps. These were narrower and steeper, and I struggled to keep moving. At the top, I turned to look back. One of the guardsmen looked away from my gaze. The other never met it. He pounded on a door that had a little barred window in it until a woman with dark hair and brown eyes came and looked through the bars.
"What is it?"
she demanded.
"Lock of four,"
one of them said. She raised her brows.
"For whom?"
He gestured down. She stood on her tiptoes to look down at me.
"Oh,"
she said.
"Very well."
I saw her puzzlement, but she unlocked the door, and we went into a very small room. She turned away from us and unlocked a second door. Bright sunlight flooded in, and she led us out onto a flat, unroofed area. I blinked my eyes and then lifted my hand to shade them. Light bounced back at me from a white floor. I squinted. It was a large area with tall walls, and I caught a glimpse of a guard walking slowly on top of the wall. We were on the roof of the stronghold. The tall, graceful towers I had glimpsed rose from each corner of the structure.
"This way,"
she said. I followed the woman, and the guardsman came behind me. I held one hand over my sun-dazzled eyes, squinting through my spread fingers. It seemed ridiculous, small me in the midst of such vigilance. We crossed an open space and then entered a narrower way, fronted with iron-barred chambers on both sides. Some were occupied, but most were empty. I halted when the woman halted. She looked down at me.
"Now we wait for the four, for only they have the keys to these last four cells. Give me that sack."
I surrendered my small carry pack reluctantly. She opened it and looked inside. "Just clothes," I told her. She said nothing as she rummaged through my tattered garments, then handed it back to me. I heard a door shut and low, contentious voices, and squinted back the way we had come. The four. The moment they became aware we were waiting, their conversation ceased. Each had a guard accompanying them. They walked briskly to where we stood. Simpf took an elaborate key on a jeweled fob from a pocket concealed in her skirts. She handed it to her guard, who inserted it into a long bar and turned it with a sharp snap. Then she stepped back as Coltrey handed a key with a white bone handle to his guard. Another snap. When all four keys had been inserted and turned, the woman who had guided us slid the long metal bar to one side and opened the door. She motioned me inside. As I stepped through the door, I heard a deep, soft voice from the next cell.
"What, Simpf? Not even a hello? Coltrey, you should wash your face. You look ridiculous. Felody, have you no youngster to bugger today? Ah, and here is Capra. I see you have washed the blood off your hands for this visit. How formal of you."
Not a one of them flinched or responded. I was within my cage and couldn't peer into the next one, but I wondered who it was who so boldly challenged the four. Then the first guardswoman shut the barred door with a clang. Each guard stepped forward to turn a key and remove it, and then present it to their master or mistress.
"Child,"
Capra said abruptly,
"tell me your name and your father's name."
I had rehearsed it. "I am B. Badgerlock of Withywoods. My father is Holder Tom Badgerlock. He manages the sheep and the orchards and the grounds for Lord Fitzchivalry. Please, just let me go home." Her eyes were flat. I hadn't lied, not at all. I looked at her earnestly. Without a farewell or words of any sort, they all walked away. From the next cell, I heard that soft voice again.
11 adults to lock up one little child. Are they right to fear you?"
I dared no response. They might ignore him, but I thought they might come back to beat me. Clutching my bundle, I surveyed my cell. There was a pot for waste in the corner, and a low bedstead with a straw-stuffed mattress with a single blanket of undyed wool at the foot of it. The back wall of my cell was of lacy white stone. The openings that let in air and light were shaped like leaves and flowers and seashells. I tried my hand in one. It could fit, and I could reach all the way through to the outer wall. The wall was as thick as my hand and forearm. These cells would be unpleasant in winter, I thought to myself. Then I wondered if winter even came to this region, and whether I would live long enough to see it. The cell was not much wider than the bed, with just room for me to walk past it. The door and the wall that faced the walkway were of bars. I had an unimpeded view of the empty cell across from mine. I would have no privacy here, not for using the waste pot or for changing out of my urine-soaked trousers. I could not quite poke my head out between the bars. I looked as far as I could up and down the walkway, but saw no one. I had a small amount of private time. I pulled out the blue trousers that Trader Acriel had given me. I'd been wearing them the night they killed her. Her favorite shade of blue, and some brown spots of her blood. There were gaping holes in the knees now, and the cuffs were frayed to fringe, but they were dry. I hastily changed and then spread my wet trousers on the floor of my cell to dry. I sat down on the edge of the bed. The straw mattress was thin. It crushed flat beneath me, and I felt the ropes of the bedstead. It would, I decided, be more comfortable to pull the mattress off the bedstead and sleep on the floor. I went again to the door and peered out. The walkway was still empty. Only then did I allow myself to open the collar of my shirt. I tucked my chin and nose inside it and smelled the elusive, fading scent of honeysuckle from my battered, flaking candle.
"Mama,"
I said aloud, as I had not said since I was very small. Tears stung my eyes, as if my spoken word had summoned grief from the grave rather than any remembrance of her.
"You are very, very young to be in such a large amount of trouble,"
the soft voice said. I froze and made no sound, my heart hammering. The voice was deep, and though the words were in common, they were flavored with a foreign accent.
Tell me, little thing, what wrong have you done? Or what wrong do the four imagine you have done to merit being locked away like this?
I said nothing. I sat as small as I could, unmoving, lest the crackling of straw betray that I was there. He did not speak for a long time. Then he said,
When I was a boy, this was a beautiful place. There were no cells here then. It had been quarters for an emperor's wives. But by the time I knew this place, it was a lovely roof garden. Latticework pergolas gentled the sun. All manner of flowers and healing herbs grew here in pots. I used to come here in the evenings when the night-blooming jasmine flavored the air, and on the hottest nights, when the wind off the sea cooled these chambers, I'd sleep up here.
He spoke on, not asking any questions, and I listened silently as the light slowly, slowly faded from the long summer afternoon. I heard the woman who had opened the door speaking to someone. No one answered. I sat still. I heard her steps, and her voice came again, closer.
Here you are.
This time, I heard some muttered thanks. I dared to slip silently from my bed and venture to the door. I heard footsteps and the soft clatter of dishes on a tray. The footsteps paused, and a woman said something and received more muttered thanks. I listened intently and heard her stop twice more before she reached the cell next to mine. It was the guard who had unlocked the door to admit me. She set a dish on the floor and slid it wordlessly under the barred door of my neighbor's cell. When she came to mine, she frowned and shook her head.
So small you are. Here's your food. I'll return with water for you.
She took a breath as if to speak more, but then folded her lips and moved on. Only two bowls remained on her tray. I heard her pause twice more toward the end of the corridor. So, seven of us held in what had looked like 20 or more cells. I drew my bowl closer and considered it. The stringy vegetable lumps were a peculiar orange color. There were six of them, on a bed of a grain I did not recognize. Shreds of cabbage added their strong odor, and some other green herb had been chopped and sprinkled over it. A little paddle was thrust into the pottage. I ate it all, though the herb stung my tongue, and when she came back to take my dish and leave me a little pot of water with a fat base and a narrow neck, I drank almost all of it. A little I set aside, thinking that if she brought me more water tomorrow, this much I would use to wash my face. A long evening deepened into a darker night. The guard came to light the lamp, a fat pot with a little wick sticking out of its spout. The flame burned very white and gave off a smell like pine trees. The night wind whispered through the walls, bringing with it the smell of the sea. As the sun went down, I heard the gulls crying. I sat on the edge of my bed and thought of the four discussing what I might be and wondered what I could make them believe. They knew too much. Capra knew my father was the unexpected son, so I could not claim that. I told them I was the only child of a servant, stolen from my ravaged home, just a simple little girl. If they believed that, would they release me? Sell me? Or kill me as worthless? If they knew what my dreams had told me I was, they would certainly kill me. I wanted Wolffather, but dared not lower my walls. What if there were others in Clarys who had the same sort of powers as Vindelire? Night darkened. I heard whispering from the other cells, but I could not make out the words. I wondered who else was held here and what they had done. I stood and shook out the blanket that I scarcely needed in so warm a place. I took off my shoes and put them neatly side by side. I dragged the sad floppy mattress off the bed frame, spread it on the floor in the open space near the door, and folded it in half to give it some thickness. I put the blanket on top of it, curled up on it, and closed my eyes. I woke up with tears on my cheeks and my throat tight. I felt my father's hand on my head, and I reached up to seize it.
Da! Why did it take so long for you to find me? I want to go home.
He didn't answer, but gently pulled his fingers through my tangled curls. Then the deep, rich voice spoke again.
So, little one, what did you do?
I caught my breath and sat up. The light from the kettle lamp barely reached me. I scrabbled back from what the feeble light showed me. A hand had reached around the corner from the next cell and into mine. The skin was the blackest I had ever seen on any living creature. That hand had been touching my head. I tried to quiet my breathing, but I was panting with fear. The voice came again.
How can you be afraid of me? There is a wall between us. I can do you no harm. Talk to me, little one, for I have been here so very long, and no one else speaks to me. I would like to know what goes on in the great outside world. What brought you here?
The hand turned over, showing me a paler palm. I imagined that the owner of the hand must be lying on the floor of the next cell, shoulder pressed tight against the barred wall to reach through to my cell. He said nothing more, and the hand just lay there, open and imploring.
Who are you?
I asked, and then, what did you do? Was I next door to a murderer? I reminded myself of how kind Dwalia had been in the first moments I met her. I would not be tricked so easily again.
My name is Prilcop. I was the white prophet of my time, but that was many, many years ago. I've been through many, many skin changes in my life.
A dim memory stirred. Had Dwalia said that name? Had I read it in my father's papers?
And why am I here?
He continued. He spoke very softly. I edged closer to the bars to hear his answer.
For speaking the truth, for doing my duty to the world. Come, child, I'm nothing to fear, and I think you need a friend. What's your name, little one?
I didn't want to tell him. Instead, I asked, why does no one speak to you?
They're afraid of me. Or more exactly, they're afraid of what they might hear. Afraid they might learn something that will trouble them.
I can't be in any more trouble. I meant my words one way. He took them another.
I think that is quite possibly true. Nor can I have any more trouble than I already do. So, tell me your story, little one.
I was quiet, thinking. I could not trust anyone. Anything I told him, he might tell others. Might that be useful? They came to my house in the middle of a bright, snowy day, right before Winterfest, to steal me, because they thought I was the unexpected son. But I'm not. I tried to be so careful of what I told him, but once I began to talk to him, words dropped from my mouth, often out of order or choked to a squeak by the tightness of my throat. I never put my hand in his, but somehow he ended up holding both my dirty bare feet in his one big black hand. I talked in circles, telling him part of the tale and then going back to explain Vindelire and telling him of hiding Perseverance under my cloak. But he was probably dead anyway, and how they had stolen Shun with me, but she had escaped. I started shaking as I told him, and he gently pressed my feet and said nothing. Over and over, I insisted their taking me was a terrible mistake, and when my confused telling was all spilled in splattered tears and words, he said,
"Poor little thing, you are not the expected son. I know, for I have met him, and his prophet."
I grew very still. Was it a trick? But what he said next was even more frightening.
I dreamed you. You became possible the day the beloved was pulled back from death, undoing so many, many dream prophecies. On that day, I knew something had torn through all the futures and replaced them with new possibilities. It terrified me, I had believed my days as a dream prophet were well and truly spent, that my time was over, and I could return home. Then the dream of you came. Oh, I did not know it would be you then, but I was shocked and afraid of your coming. I tried to make it less likely. As soon as Beloved and his Catalyst returned to me, as soon as I could, I persuaded them to part. I thought I had done enough to shift the world into a better path. The big hand closed briefly around my foot. But when I began dreaming about you again, I knew it was too late. You existed, and by your existence, you created many possible divergences from the true path. You dreamed of me? I wiped my wet face with my shirt front. I did. What did you dream? His hand went lax under my feet. I didn't move them. His words came as slow as dripping honey. I dreamed many dreams, not always about you, but futures that became possible when you existed. I dreamed of a wolf that unmasked a puppeteer. I dreamed of a scroll that unwrote itself. I dreamed of a man who shook planks off himself and became two dragons. I dreamed that one too. I spoke before I considered if I should. Silence, save for two other prisoners whispering down the corridor. I'm not surprised, though I am frightened. But why are those dreams me? He laughed softly. I dreamed a whirlwind of fire come to change everything. I reached out to take its hand. Do you know what happened?
It burned you?
No. It offered me its foot instead. Its little bare foot. I snatched my feet back as if I were the one who had been burned. He laughed softly, very quietly. Done is done, little one. I know you now. I knew you would come. I did not expect you to be a child. So, now will you tell me your name?
I thought carefully. My name is B.
He said nothing. His hand was still there, open on the cell floor. I thought it must be very uncomfortable for him to lie on his floor and reach around to my cell like that.
If you dreamed about me, can you tell me what is going to happen to me?
His stillness was like a curtain. The lamp in the corridor outside my cell was running out of oil. I did not have to see it to know how the flame danced on the end of the wick, sucking up the last of it. Finally, the dark, rich voice spoke again.
B, nothing happens to you. You happen to everything.
Slowly, he drew his hand back. He did not speak again that night.
Chapter 25. Bribes.
Our informants have indicated that a large shipment of excellent quality jade and turquoise, both raw and worked, is being amassed at Curl Bay on the Reedon Peninsula. Another ship there is loading excellent hardwood timbers. In the past 6 months, three Lurics have dreamed about a great storm. Two dreamed of ships broken and wrecked on the rock as clouds parted to reveal a quarter moon. While we remain uncertain of the exact month of the storm, three Lurics felt this event to be close in the future paths. It is the opinion of this collator that if a ship were stationed in Scalin Cove near the Hark Rocks, following the storm there might be excellent scavenging. It might be a good idea to have on such a vessel the sort of sailors who could deal with those who might dispute ownership of such a valuable cargo as well. Even if our vessel must remain at the ready for 6 months, the profit would still be substantial. Report to the fore from
from Kalaita Jens of the 7th rank. How could I have slept so heavily? I spoke to a woman, nudging me. She had pushed the toe of her sandaled foot under the barred door and was poking me with it.
Move away, please. I will slide your porridge in.
Her voice was low and neutral. Sunlight washed lace patterns on the floor. Shells. Flowers. I sat up, and for a time nothing made sense. Then I remembered. Dwalia beaten bloody and me in a cell. And then the night. A friend? I stood up and pressed my face against the bars, trying to see into the next cell. All I could see was slightly more of the corridor. The woman who had woken me had brown hair and eyes. She wore a simple garment of pale blue, sleeveless, and sashed at the waist. It stopped at her knees, and on her feet she had simple leather sandals. She stooped and set her tray on the floor, took a bowl of porridge from it, and slid the bowl under the barred door. Plain beige porridge in a white bowl. No cream, no honey, no berries. No withywoods, no clatter of cooking and waiting for my father to come. Just plain porridge with a wooden spoon stuck in it. I tried to be grateful as I ate it. It tasted of nothing. When the woman came back to take the bowl, I asked her, "May I have water to wash myself?" She looked puzzled at my request.
"I wasn't told to give you any."
"Can you ask permission to give me some?" Her eyebrows rose to almost her hairline.
"Of course not."
The dark, rich voice from the night before spoke.
"She cannot do anything except what she is told to do."
"That isn't true,"
the woman exclaimed, and then clapped both hands over her mouth. She stooped, hastily piled my bowl onto the waiting tray, and hurried off so quickly that the dishes jounced noisily on the tray.
"You scared her,"
I said.
"She scares herself. They all do."
I was distracted by the sound of the door opening at the end of the walkway. I pressed my cheek hard to the bars and saw the four enter one at a time. They were not dressed as grandly today, but they still wore their colours. Four soldiers followed them. Simph was in a loose red gown. It had no sleeves and fell from her shoulders to her feet in folds, interrupted only by a scarlet belt that cinched it at her waist. Felody was in a long yellow tunic and trousers that barely reached his knees. Some of Coltrey's cosmetics had flaked onto his green vest as if he had just come in from a snowfall. Capra's attire surprised me. She wore what looked to me like a blue shirt with loose, flowing sleeves. If she had trousers on at all, they were shorter than the skirt was long. Her bared legs were sturdy, but as pale as a fish's belly. She wore sandals of brown leather that slapped against her feet as she walked. I had never seen anyone so attired, and I stared at her when she stood outside my cage.
"Unlock,"
Simph announced, and offered an elaborate fob to the guard. The man took it, then stepped forward and inserted an oddly shaped key into the bar that closed my door and turned it. One after another, each of the other three guards received a key and turned it in the lock. When all four keys had been turned and were standing in the bar, Capra stepped forward and slid the bar aside.
"You will come with me,"
she told me as I stepped out of the cell. She spoke to the other three as the guards retrieved the keys and restored them to each owner.
"I will return her at the beginning of the third watch. You will meet me here with your key guards."
She looked down at me.
"Will you obey me and stay by my side, or must I leash you?"
The key guard who attended her held up for my inspection a chain and collar. I looked from it to Capra. "I will obey you," I lied.
"Good. Come along, then."
The others stepped out of our way, and I followed on Capra's heels, her guard behind me. I longed to peer into the cell next to mine, but her guard herded me quickly past. I had only the briefest glimpse of a black man sitting on a bunk, his head bowed. Behind us, I heard Simph say to Coltrey and Felody, I do not approve of this. It is true the girl may be nothing at all. She may not even have white bloodlines. I have heard that folk from the mountains in the far north are sometimes as pale as true whites. But what if Dwalia spoke true, and somehow she is the unexpected son from the dreams? Why should Capra have the first opportunity to speak with her?
Because you all agreed to it.
Capra called sharply over her shoulder. To me, she said,
Don't dawdle.
I did not feel that we fled, but we certainly left their company as swiftly as we could. Few of the cells we passed were occupied. The prisoners sat sedately on their beds, doing nothing. As if she heard my unvoiced question, Capra said,
They are not evil, simply willful. We put them here to correct them. They will become useful, and then they will be allowed to rejoin their fellows. Or they won't.
She did not say what else would befall them if they did not become useful. For a white-haired old woman, she moved very quickly as we descended the same steps I had climbed the day before. Down we went, until we reached the ground floor. When we emerged in the main corridor, she swiftly led me off in a different direction. We passed chambers with their doors open, and I glimpsed windows that looked out onto a lovely garden. Soon enough, we entered a room with statuary and cushioned benches. Beyond it was a garden with a large pool in the middle. We crossed swiftly through it, and I felt almost dizzied by the heady fragrance of the trees in bloom. There was a shady portico along a long wall with a series of doors in it. She opened one. I smelled a sharp scent on the cloud of steam that rolled out.
Go wash yourself, your hair, your feet, all of you. You will find garments on a bench there. After you have dried yourself, put them on and come out. Do not be slow, but be thorough. You stink.
She delivered her command and her judgment in an impersonal tone. The prospect of warm water made me swift to obey her. I entered and was glad to close the door behind me. Light came into the room from high windows. My hope that there might be another exit was quickly dashed. In the room was a bench with the promised clean garments and some sandals beneath it, and a drying cloth. There was a pot of something soft like pudding. I dipped my fingers into it and rubbed them together. Soap, I surmised, scented with some sharp herb. A low tub of smoothed and polished stone held steaming water. There was nothing else in the room. I stripped hastily, with many a backward glance at the door. I rolled my dirty garments around my precious candle and set it carefully on the bench before I stepped down into the tub. It was far deeper than I had expected. The water was almost too hot and came up to my chin when I sat down. For a moment, it was all I could do just to sit there. I leaned back and let myself sink completely under the water. When I came up, I saw that pale brown rivulets of dirty water were coming from my hair. I was not surprised, but I was still embarrassed. I helped myself to a handful of the soap and stood up to scrub myself with it. After a bit of hesitation, I rubbed it through my hair as well, and then rinsed myself in the now greyish water. I had not been naked since my time with Trader Acriel, and the fading browns and greens of various bruises still showed on my hips and shins. My toenails were cracked, and rub as I might, some dirt remained caught in them. The skin of my hands had been roughened by the various tasks I'd done for Dwalia, the hands of a servant, not a high-born buck girl. I knew a moment of shame that I had not known before, that the kitchen girl's chapped hands were evidence of the sort of work that had never been expected of me. So often I had cursed the events that had taken me away from my comfortable life, and now I had a little jolt of realization. How would it have been to be born a slave or a servant, to know that the abuse I'd suffered was to be my daily life? I put on the garments and felt oddly naked in them. They were loose and the trousers came barely to my knees. But the sleeves of the blouse fell past my wrists. The fabric of both garments was light and a pale rose in colour. There was no way to carry the candle inside my new shirt. The sandals were a mystery, but I finally strapped them to my feet. Beneath the clothing, I found a comb. The water had put my hair into tight curls, but I did my best to make it tidy. I folded the drying cloths and looked for a way to drain the grey bathwater.
but didn't find one. It shamed me that someone would see how dirty I'd been. I steeled myself, tucked my worn garments, with the candle inside them, under my arm, and left the bath. Daylight had grown stronger, and the morning was warmer than many a noon in Buck. Capra looked me up and down, with her gaze lit.